Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, since horses and cows have been domesticated, they've contributed a whole lot to our lifestyles and our livelihoods. And we'll be talking today a bit about the history of large animal veterinary medicine, as well as the care for sheep, goats, cows, horses, llamas, you name it, with our guest, Dr. Alexandra Burton. She's a clinical assistant professor at UW's Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Dr. Burton specializes in large animal medicine and critical care and equine geriatric medicine. She also has experience in veterinary care of alpacas and llamas. So if you have a large animal on your farm or maybe as a pet, I'd love to hear from you. What do you want to know about caring for horses or sheep or goats or alpacas or llamas or maybe even pigs? Join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Burton, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's very exciting, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, tell us about the UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Give us a little info on it.
So we are quite unique with respect to the fact that we see all large animals. So we don't just care for horses. As you mentioned, we look after cattle, goats, sheep, quite a few pigs, and they're usually pet pigs, and then also llamas and alpacas. And so we do it all, and we've even had a few reindeer, antelopes. And so we basically, if you have an animal in that category of a large animal and it needs help, we're there 24/7. We have people that work round the clock. We've got a team of excellent resident veterinarians. So they're veterinarians who are qualified, and they're getting further qualifications to become board certified in large animal medicine or surgery. And so, you know, we're all here and we're all working because we absolutely love what we do. And I can genuinely say that going to work is not going to work for me. And for most of the people that I work with, we genuinely love doing what we do and seeing the large animals of all types. And for me, many of the large animal hospitals, they're separated into equine and then other species. And I really like, and as do my colleagues, seeing all the different species. And that's a huge plus of the large animal hospital at UW.
Just thinking about James Herriot's books and wondering if his books had any influence on you and wanting to become a veterinarian for large animals.
I'd be lying if I said no. So yeah, I was brought up on James Herriot, the books and the original television series of James Herriot, and you know, we do do it all, apart from we don't have the tricky woos. So in large animal, we do not deal with the dogs and cats.
There you go. And now there's a new series, too, that it's been airing on Wisconsin Public Television. So, yeah, it's kind of continuing on. Well,
yeah.
You're providing care then for that whole broad range of animals at UW?
Yes, that's right. And so we're split into medicine and surgery. And so I'm from the medicine section, and we do anything that doesn't involve, you know, an incision being made and an operation. And so if, you know, the animal needs intensive care with fluids and nursing and antibiotics, and pain management. This is something that the medicine department does, but we work very closely with the surgery department, which is in the same building. So if an animal, a pet is lame or requires an operation, then, you know, that the surgeons will do that, and we're not a separate building. We work in the same office and the same pens and stalls. So we do work on a huge variety, but one thing that I don't do and probably won't be very good at is doing operations.
I know you published research about large animal infectious diseases. That's been an area for you. The general public, I think myself included, has learned a lot more about infectious diseases through the coronavirus pandemic, frankly. Do large animals spread that type of problem the same way that we do?
They can do, and it depends on the type of infectious disease. So some infectious diseases, I'll use strangles in horses as an example, because it's very commonly known about, and that's an upper respiratory infection where they get snotty noses, and that is spread by aerosol, like COVID and close contact, but it's horse to horse. So it's a horse, generally a horse specific thing. And so only horses can get it by close contact. Other types of infectious diseases, such as Salmonella, they are less infectious, meaning you need much more of an exposure to get infected, but they can cross between species more easily. And all the advice regarding COVID with the hand washing and being hygienic, it really applies across the board. And it is what we do as veterinarians, anyway, is to maintain cleanliness. And that's been since back in the 1800s, they knew that. They knew that, keeping things clean and washing your hands and was one of the key elements to controlling infectious disease, regardless of what infectious disease it was. So that is interesting, and it never really changes.
I guess there's some evidence that, and you don't work with mink, but mink can be a carrier of COVID. Is that true for, at least as far as we know, concerning the large animals or not?
As far as we know at this point, large animals cannot pass or carry COVID. Thankfully, there are coronaviruses that infect large animals, but they're very, very different. So they're different types of coronavirus, such as bovine coronavirus, which has been known about for years and years and years, and that's cattle specific, affects bovines. And it's the same type of virus, but it's not anything like the COVID-19, which is, as you mentioned, mink and mainly humans.
Yeah. You specialize in geriatric care for horses. That's an area, a big area of interest for you. How long do horses actually live? What's the average lifespan of a horse, and what issues do they encounter as they age?
So that's a super question, and I like to say, and this is true, that 30 is the new 20 for horses. So they are living longer. They used to live, around 20 was an old horse, but it is not uncommon for your horse to live to the late 20s, even early 30s, depending on, the breed, the type of life they've had, any illness and injury. But they are living longer than they used to 20 years ago. So as with humans and as life expectancy has increased, and I'm very interested in, you know, geriatric care of all large animal species, because I had an old horse myself who recently passed away, and it's incredible if you recognize the problems that they can have, such as problems with their teeth. They can't eat as well. You need to change their diet. As with people, they have problems with arthritis, so you need to make sure that they maintain a healthy body weight. They're not overweight. You change what they do. With respect to horses specifically, it is if they've been working and in a job, you know, being ridden, it's often beneficial to keep them in some kind of work. There's no set age, you know, I'm going to stop. My horse is 20, I need to retire them. Just with people, it actually is beneficial to keep up some kind of level of exercise. It does need to change as they get older. And to me, it's fascinating. We have one of the big problems with horses specifically is they get what used to be known as equine Cushing syndrome, but now it's PPID. However, we refer to it as both because people, you know, are so familiar with equine Cushing syndrome that it's difficult to, it's just basically a change of the name. And that's, a benign tumor in the brain, and it basically affects the hormones. And so they become more immunosuppressed, but there is a medication that can successfully control the symptoms. And if it's diagnosed, the condition is diagnosed early, the average life expectancy after diagnosis is 9 years now. And it used to be only 5 years. And the horses develop the Cushing's or PPID any age from 15 onwards. So the age at which they develop it varies greatly between breed and type of horse. But any horse over 15 probably will develop it if they live long enough. So some will develop it when they're 15, some will develop it when they're 30. But if you diagnose it early, you can control the symptoms with the drug, which is called Prasend or Pergolide. And so that's one of the big advances in improving health. The other one is with respect to diet. The feed companies have done a very good job at producing diets specifically for older horses who have, poorer teeth, poorer digestion, and so they can, get proper nutrition that's easily absorbed as they get older into their late 20s.
Well, lots to talk about here on this, and we're going to get into all of that. I'm really interested in the Cushing's, equine Cushing syndrome, and the equine metabolic syndrome as well, EMS. And, of course, you have a chance to join in, too, as we visit with our guest today, Dr. Alexandra Burton, clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jana Rose Schleiss, our producer today, our on-air producer, Jane Rotunda, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at veterinary care and your large animals' health with our guest today, Dr. Alexandra Burton, clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Talk about a lot of animals, and we've been going through a few of them with you. And I hope you'll join in if you have questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. And you know what? Let's take a call. Aaron in Viola, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I was just wanting to call in to talk about, we raised sheep for lamb, some years ago with a flock of our sheep. I ended up having a lot of premature lambs being born, and we sent some of them in, and, they tested positive for what was known as Q fever, or Queensland fever. I know it's something that's just kind of shown up in this country maybe 15 years ago. And spreading rapidly, and love the, and I myself contracted it because I was dealing with a ewe that had a prolapsed uterus. And with the vet, she was not as clean as she should have been and had me helping, and I wasn't gloved. So the symptoms were very much like Lyme's disease. And I had to take doxycycline, and much like Lyme's, it'll kind of pop up every little bit. Just love to know any information you have on what the prospects on Q fever are right now here, and if we're seeing any rise in that, and any other information you might know.
Thanks very much, Aaron. Appreciate your call. Sorry for the affliction passing to you. Dr. Burton, comments?
Yes, Aaron. I'm sorry that you had a Q fever. It is one of the, you know, it's one of the risks, and we're, as veterinarians, we're taught, if you have, you know, lambings, they recommend wearing a face mask and long gloves, because it's always a risk. And you know, now with the COVID era, we're generally all masked anyway. But even before this, it's what we're taught and what we teach the students to be very aware of Q fever. I am not aware of any increases. It's not something that we have seen recently in the large animal hospital. They may have had some post-mortem cases at the WVDL, so our diagnostic laboratory, but we have not had any since I've been here for 18 months at the hospital. However, you know, the biggest piece of advice is to, you know, a mask, you know, N95 or higher grade, and, you know, long gloves for lambings. So I'm not sure that answers your question. And I'm sorry that you contracted that, because it is nasty. And as you said, it's one of those things that crops up again, like brucellosis. If a veterinarian happens to contract that, that was common in the UK a while ago, tuberculosis as well, and Lyme, but that's not necessarily from animals. It's mainly from ticks.
Yeah. So is there a display? What do animals display with this issue?
So it's,
or present, I should say.
Yeah, they present with abortions, or they don't even have to abort. It can be a relatively normal lambing, but they can still be shedding it highly in the afterbirth and the placenta, or it can present with abortions.
Hmm. So outwardly, as you look at the sheep, the ewe itself, it's really tough to kind of figure it out until something like that happens then.
Yes, that's right.
So a tough situation. Aaron, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I want to go back to the equine Cushing syndrome. Is that displayed in horses similar to what Cushing's disease is displayed in people?
Yes, it is, and that's why it was named equine Cushing syndrome. They develop hirsutism, which is a long, long, thick, furry coat, a pot belly. They're more susceptible to infections, and that's why it was originally named equine Cushing syndrome. It's now officially called PPID, because the actual cause of it is slightly different to human Cushing's. However, the manifestations and the symptoms are very, very similar. So it's really just terminology. They can also demonstrate increased drinking and increased urination. And one of the first signs that you will notice is horses shed their winter coat roughly at the same time every year. So if you have a horse and you know, my horse always starts shedding in the middle of February. My own horse used to start shedding on Valentine's Day, February 14th, always started shedding then. And until one year she didn't, and it was into March. And sometimes that is one of the first signs, is they a delay in shedding of their winter coat. And then the muscles along their back will become a little less strong and a little more dipped than you're used to seeing. The advanced signs are a very thick, curly coat that does not shed at all. And they can get laminitis and have a very sort of fat, pot-bellied appearance, frequent infections. And so those are advanced symptoms, but it's better to catch it as early as possible with the diagnostic test and clinical signs, because then you can prevent more serious consequences. The most serious is laminitis, and you can prevent them but if you get your horse on medication, which is Pergolide, and you're aware that this is Larry has a cat in the background, which is, you know, I love cats. I love cats. I had to say that. Cats and large animals, yeah. So if you get your horse on the medication early, you can really prevent a lot of life-threatening clinical signs. So it's a really good thing. And to diagnose it is a blood test. Initially, a simple blood test can help you diagnose it.
We have, another caller online, and Tiger, my kitty, likes to come and visit during the show and listen in to hear what's on, especially when we have a veterinarian on. Let's go to Aaron in Kenosha County. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, great show today, and I was just at the Kenosha County Fair last week with some of my animals, but I don't have horses, but stopped at the horse barn, and I was surprised to see a 28-year-old mare at the Kenosha County Fair this week. So, yeah, those horses do live pretty long, and I was surprised to see that and hear that today. But also, question about zoonotic diseases with my animals. I have goats and pigs and a cow, but I also have a lot of kids at home, a lot of children, and I'm wondering if there are any diseases I should be aware of or concerned about that can be transmitted to humans.
Oh, good question.
So, yeah, thank you for your question. That's a really good question. And, you know, the zoonotic diseases that can be transmitted from farm animals and large animals to humans are definitely more of a concern in children, immunosuppressed people, and older people. And the two main ones that you need to be aware of is salmonella, so salmonellosis, and that's shed in the manure. Sometimes animals can become very, very sick and they have diarrhea, but they don't necessarily have to. They can shed it in their manure, and it's something that humans can become infected with. You need to have a large load of the Salmonella bacteria to become sick, especially if you're a healthy person. And the majority of human cases of salmonellosis come from things like spinach, you know, a batch that, of spinach that has been contaminated, so foodstuffs. But you can catch it from large animals if the hygiene with the manure is not good. So hand hygiene, if you know, get some manure on your hands and then touch your phone and then they, you know, then put their hands near their mouth. So that's the one of them, Salmonella. And then the other one, which is mainly affects young calves, is Cryptosporidium. And that can cause diarrhea in calves. 95% of calves will have Cryptosporidium, and they get over it or may not even show symptoms, but they will be shedding it in the first month of their life. Now, different to Salmonella, the Cryptosporidium only requires a very, very small number to infect a person. And if the person has not been, you know, grown up with dairy cattle or grown up on a farm, they can become very, very ill with Cryptosporidium more frequently than they become ill with Salmonella. So the Cryptosporidium is something with young dairy calves that's very, very important to wash your hands after handling them. And in this day and age, I think the mobile phone, we're always checking our phones, you know, that because they require such a low number to become infected, that's something that, you know, you need to watch out for, because some calves do not display signs of illness from Cryptosporidium, you know, and they could make children ill. Now, I did a lot of research on Cryptosporidium some years ago with calves, and with humans, what tends to happen is if you are unfortunate enough to have a bout of it once, you tend to then be immune and not contract it again in your life. But it can make people very, very ill. They have to be hospitalized basically through dehydration. And then the final thing to consider is listeriosis. So listeria can infect goats and cattle most commonly, and it shows up as neurologic disease. So, you know, they're neurologic and circling, things like that. It's sporadic, and the animals will catch it from feedstuffs, or sometimes you don't even know where they've contracted it. If they're out in pasture, it can be somewhat random. Now, listeria from an animal that is showing neurologic signs is unlikely to infect a person. People most commonly get listeriosis from cheese. So if there's cheese at a fair that's unpasteurized or has been sitting out, that is the most common. So those are the three that spring to mind. And it basically comes down to being, you know, sensible and clean, and washing your hands after you've handled animals.
Yeah, makes good sense. Aaron, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's turn to David in New Richmond. David, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry. I was hoping your guest could talk about laminitis a little bit more, that it's really not a death sentence or 86 for an animal if they get it, if it's treated correctly. Certainly, if it goes too far, it can be, but if you catch it soon enough, it is not the death sentence that a lot of people think it is. We had a horse, one of my roping horses, somebody gave him a fresh bale of alfalfa, and luckily a vet told me to ice him down completely, his body, And we were able to keep him on a dry lot for about a year, and he came out of it. And we just recently had a beef cow. When we turned her out this year on the green grass, she got laminitis. Everybody told me to kill her, and she had a calf, and I thought, you know, I can bring her 5 gallons of water and a bale of hay every other day. That cow is now walking around. You could not pick her out from the rest of the cows that she had laminitis. So if your guests could comment about it, I'd sure appreciate it.
David, thank you so much.
Yeah, David, that's a super question, and you've really you've hit the nail on the head. So laminitis is, you're correct, it is not a death sentence if you get on it, you know, quickly. So I'm glad you brought up the cattle, because people, we tend to sort of associate it with horses, but cattle can get it too, horses more commonly. And, you know, it's, if a horse has had a bout, or a cow has had a bout of laminitis once, they are more likely to get it again. However, the most proven treatment for kind of halting laminitis is, as you said, icing the feet from, you know, the foot to the knee for as long as you can in the first phase, and rest as well. And it does take time and patience, and sometimes, you know, special farriery. I had a pony myself 10 years ago. I call him a pony. He was a Rocky Mountain cross quarter horse, stock horse. And he unfortunately developed, when I inherited him, he'd had a bout of laminitis. And he surprised me, because he really did quite well. He had a first bout with me. He was about 24. And, you know, we did everything that you described. So I iced his feet, rested him a little, used some anti-inflammatories, and he came back into full work. And I think it's about being aware of, you know, you mentioned the causative factors that are in no way your fault, but it's being aware of, this animal is going to be prone because they've had it before, and then what things might cause it. But then sometimes with patience and with sensible management, you can get them recovered and get them out of it again. So I'm very glad that you brought that up.
And, you know, Nelson emailed with a question relating to laminitis. He says he thinks laminitis is like a fever blister, and wonders if this icing actually stops the deterioration. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the icing has been proven to halt the laminitis in its cause and prevent it from developing. So the experimental models, which they've, the majority of the work has been done in Australia and at the University of Pennsylvania. And they induce laminitis in horses. And if they ice them from their foot all the way up to their knee for the first 72 hours, they will not develop laminitis in that foot. It's a difficult thing to do for some horses, to keep them iced. Practically, it's very challenging. I worked in Georgia for 4 years, and with it being so hot down there, getting the ice changed quick enough before it melts is very, very challenging. But it basically puts the foot on hold. So it stops the metabolism, it stops everything. So you're kind of putting it on ice, as they do for, you know, sometimes with people, if they've, you know, been out in the cold and been frozen, sometimes it's something that would save them, because you're slowing down the metabolism and you're preventing the damage that happens, which is when the bone of the foot, which is held to the hoof by soft tissue and connections and blood vessels, you're stopping that from becoming swollen and then breaking away. And so that's the goal with the ice. And it really is the only thing that's been proven. The difficulty with it is maintaining it, especially in the summer. I think in Wisconsin in the winter, maintaining ice would not be too challenging.
Yeah, I was thinking about my plastic freezy things that my daughter had for cross country. I wondered if you wrap those around or if you make the horse stand in a pail of ice water or what?
Yeah, so you have to make them stand in ice. So it has to be the ice that contacts the skin that cold. If somebody could invent something that would be cold enough, because the freeze wraps that are used for competition, they just don't get it cold enough. They've tried and they don't work. But if someone could invent something that would get it cold enough, they would make a lot of money. But so far, it is just you have to have the ice, the crushed ice, contacting the hoof and contacting the skin and the fur, the hair.
Dr. Alexandra Burton, our guest today, clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Questions for her? Give a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at large animal veterinary care, all kinds of farm animals. We can talk about llamas. We can talk about a lot of animals with our guest today, Dr. Alexandra Burton, clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. What have you done with when your large animals got sick? What do you want to know about diagnosing large animals? Those are a couple of questions you might ask with our guests. And again, we'd love to hear from you. Karen emailed, could you address any new treatments for navicular in horses?
Karen, that's a super question and something that I am interested in. With navicular, the surgeons often deal with that side of things, but I am personally quite interested in the syndrome, having had a horse that, suffered from it. And one of the things that we can use is we have a standing CT, and the standing CT helps basically look in far more detail at the foot than an X-ray would. And the horse does not need to be anesthetized. They are just sedated. And then you look at the foot and you can look at the bones and also the tendons. And so, navicular can be a combination of the navicular bone disintegrating and then the knock-on effects of that, which affect the joints and the tendons that run over the navicular bone, especially the deep digital flexor tendon. Now, with respect to advances in treatment, I know that for several years, people have been doing injections of the navicular bursa with steroids or joint lubrication, and that's done with radiographic guidance usually. So that's putting medicine directly into the affected area. And then, another another method of addressing, you know, if your horse has navicular syndrome or caudal heel pain, so the back of the heel pain is what the surgeons like to refer to it as rather than navicular, although it does all center around that fragile navicular bone, and some horses are much more prone to it than others depending on their breed and what they do for work. And very interestingly, I was reading a relatively old book written by a famous event rider, and he had a horse that had navicular syndrome, and one thing that he did was he changed the type of work that he did with that horse. So he reduced the amount of circling work and the amount of, you know, hard work on hard surfaces, and changed it more to, you know, a straight line work, avoiding turns. And so I think that one of the big methods of helping horses with navicular is, you know, first of all, diagnosing it correctly, and then there are some injections and interventions. But then you may need to change what the horse does for a living. They tend not to do well if they have to circle tightly, so if they have to do barrel work or dressage. But they do better if they're going in straight lines. And so that's something that's very, very interesting to me, because I've seen several cases managed successfully by changing the job that the horse does to put less stress on that area. And then the final part is the shoeing. So we have Martin, our farrier at UW. He comes every Thursday, and he's excellent. He works on horses mainly, but I've recently been working with him on a sheep, and he's done very good work for the sheep, worked wonders actually. But the farrowery, so just changing the angle of the foot slightly, can really help as well. So there are lots of parts to it, but it starts with diagnosing exactly where in the navicular area the problem is. Is it, you know, a flare because of, you know, a small fracture that's gone into the tendon, or we call it an enthesiophyte. It's a tiny little bit of extra bone. Is it damage to the tendon that runs over the bone? Is it damage to the actual navicular bone? So that's where you start with it. And then there's a combination of things. And there's no magical new cure per se, but we are getting further with, you know, again, as mentioned, laminitis was, you know, a death sentence. It's not necessarily a death sentence. It may be career ending in terms of what the horse's job is, but their horse may just need to change their job.
Okay. Diane in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance now. Thanks for calling, Diane.
Oh, my pleasure, and great show, and thank you for your good work, Doctor. I have a two-part response. The first is, we had show jumpers, high-level show jumpers, international ones, for many years, and you know, I did a lot of reading, and University of Pennsylvania was always an excellent source. But I remember when the horse would start, you know, after a particularly hard campaign, we'd not only poultice the leg and wrap it, but we had a pair of boots, rubber boots, that went up high, and they were loose, very loose, and over the knee, and we'd put ice in the boot, and it was almost like a firefighter's boot. And then there was a strap, like a rubber strap over the top of the withers. And, you know, you pour the ice in, and the ice stayed a long time. Of course, you had to keep the horse in a stall, you know, or depending on how long you left the boots on in the cross ties in the bathing area. But that always worked very, very well. So somebody must be making those, or someone could improvise that type of situation. And the second part is I had a question about, do you care for the animals at the Milwaukee County Zoo, like the penguins and giraffes and rhinoceros? And if so, I was curious, which are the easiest to get along with?
Diane, thank you so much.
Yeah,
what did you think of the boot idea?
Yeah, so the boot idea is that I know those boots that you're talking about, and they are great. I've used them quite a lot in cases of cellulitis. So when they get, or lymphangitis, so they get very swollen front legs. But they're also good for what you describe, just as in sport, in athletes. If you see, you know, I'm a soccer fan, soccer you call it in the USA, but in American football, if there's a, you know, an injury on the pitch, one of the first things they do, always do, the physios, they come on with ice packs. And so those boots are fantastic for, you know, after a hard show jumping round, for getting the swelling down. And they always will be. We do have some in the hospital, and, you know, I use them for cellulitis cases. With respect to laminitis, the thing is the ice, it's not cold enough. It doesn't get cold enough. Because the ice has to touch the skin to make it cold enough. So it would be it needs to be a substance that is colder than ice if it's going to be inside something, because the ice actually has to touch the fur, which is the frustrating thing. But I do like those boots because they can help you use less drugs such as bute or Banamine, because ice, you know, it gets the swelling down. And then the second part of your question, so I don't deal with animals from the zoo, or I haven't done yet. I think occasionally we will have, I've seen a couple of antelope that the anesthesia and surgeons have worked on for if they're having trouble delivering their baby, if they're having trouble in labor. The most exciting species I've worked on here has been a reindeer, a couple of reindeer. There was some reindeer when I worked at Cornell, and the reindeer are quite good to work with as long as they are handled. They're very docile, and many of them are, you know, halter broken and can be quite friendly. You just have to watch out for their antlers. And sometimes wear goggles, because the antlers they're very, very big compared to the reindeer, because the reindeer is only about 3 foot long and, you know, maybe 2.5 feet tall. They're not very big, but their antlers are very big. And I have worked on a few yaks in the past, but not recently. So no penguins or anything like that. I did once treat a sea lion at the New York State Fair, but that was very sort of hands off treatment. So I don't know if that answers your question.
We do have a vet, some vets at UW who do work with zoo animals, and we've had them on the show from time to time to talk about that. I was thinking that my daughter Emily, when we have gone to Disney, the one thing she always liked to do is to go to the Animal Kingdom, to the Rafiki's Planet Lounge, where they you could watch Doc the vets working on animals, and I remember watching once through glass, of course, as the vets did some surgery on a zebra. So it was pretty cool. Well, Dr. Alexandra Burden will be with us right up till 12:30 today. Really looking forward to the rest of our conversation with her. And you'll be able to join in. You can do it right now if you want. The number is 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with Dr. Burden. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking about large and animals on the show today with our special guest, Dr. Alexandra Burden. She's a clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Done a lot of research, among other things, about how horses in World War I were cared for during battle. I would be interested in that. I might have a question for her about that. Maybe you have a question for her about that or something else relating to large animal care and disease. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. And Patrick in Madison has a question for you, Dr. Burden, so let's go there. Patrick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question, and my question is, where do cows come from? How did they become farm animals or even domesticated? We know that dogs came from wolves, and I've seen wild pigs. I've seen wild horses, but I've never seen wild cows. So where did they come from?
Ah, interesting.
Oh, Patrick, that's a super question. So to answer it, I don't know 100%. However, you may know, well, I am obviously British from my accent. And so in Britain, we have some very, very old cattle breeds, such as Highland cattle. They're known as Highlanders in the USA, and they are a very, very old breed. They are more akin to buffalo. And then there are other breeds of cattle in India, which are more adapted to not producing so much milk. They're adapted to a hotter climate. And so the modern day dairy cow is derived from, I would expect, those older species, and over the years has been bred to produce, you know, a lot of milk, because cattle, you know, in the wild, and buffalo in the wild, they produce enough milk to feed their calves, just as horses produce enough to feed their foals. Alpacas produce enough to feed their crias, but in the volumes of milk that we have in the Wisconsin dairy cow, they are very much a modern day breed. And when I say modern day, it's been evolving from the 1800s, just breeding them to produce more milk for human consumption, and to produce milk longer than they would need to raise their own offspring. So that's a fascinating question. You've made me think now. I'm going to have to go research exactly.
I'm thinking about some of the breeds that we have here in the state, the Jersey and the Guernsey, coming from probably the Isle of Jersey and the Isle of Guernsey. Holsteins as well from, I don't think there's an Isle of Holstein, but maybe there
is. No, they come from Germany.
Yeah.
So the Holsteins are from Germany, and Friesian is a British breed,
yes.
And Holstein Friesian, so that's, well, German. But you're right, the Jerseys come from the little island of Jersey, which is between England and France, and the Guernseys come from the little island of Guernsey, which is between England and France, and they are very small islands indeed. And the Highland cattle come from the Highlands. We have Aberdeen Angus, which come from Scotland, near Aberdeen. And then we have a multitude of other breeds, such as Ayrshire. They are a dairy breed, very hardy, from Scotland. So a lot of them come from Europe originally, but that's not the... They're still domesticated, those breeds.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of along those lines... A listener emailed, well, just a question about animals in general, but she wonders, how long do pigs and llamas live, and are llamas friendly?
Oh, that's a super question. So I'll answer the second question first. I'm a huge fan of llamas and alpacas. I really like them. When I was a resident training to become, you know, an expert in internal medicine, we had a lot of alpacas and llamas because it was around the early 2000s when they were much more popular. And llamas are friendly on their own terms, and it depends if they have been, well handled or not. There is a syndrome called berserk male, which is if you have a cria, which is a baby llama or a baby alpaca, and it becomes an orphan, if he is a male and he becomes very friendly with humans, they then will grow up to be extremely aggressive if they are raised on a bottle and they're a male raised by humans on a bottle, not so much for females. So they are friendly. The one thing they do, which I always tell the students, is they will spit. That is their weapon. So they're like, not true ruminants, but similar to cattle and sheep, they will chew cud and, you know, bring it up and chew it and swallow it again, their food. And sometimes they will use that food that they've brought up and they will spit it and aim it at the person that or the animal that they are upset with. And that is one of their weapons. They will spit, and you get hit in the face with some crushed up, wet, regurgitated hay. So that, is something that they do not very often, but if they're annoyed and it's not life threatening to people, they do kick occasionally again if they, are not very friendly, but it's not a kick that can really hurt anybody. And I'm probably a bit biased because I'm a huge fan of llamas and alpacas. And they live to around 15 years old is how old they live. Sometimes they can live a little longer. And as with all species, they are starting to live a bit longer with good management. And then the pigs, the length of time they live is variable. Unfortunately, pigs that are designed to be production pigs that are kept as pets, they can develop quite a lot of problems because when they're bred for production, they're not designed to live very long, more than about 5 years. They can live longer, but it's a challenge to keep them free from arthritis. The pot-bellied pigs, which are most commonly kept as pets, and we see that's the type we see the most, the pot-bellied pigs, they can usually live till 10, 11, 12, and the problems that get them is it's very challenging to keep them lean enough to keep weight off their joints and stop them developing arthritis. I hope that answers your question.
So you were talking about llamas. I was thinking about the time I did a radio show, this is a long time ago, many years back, about llamas with a llama breeder, owner of many llamas. And the person brought a llama to the show, brought it up on the freight elevator, and it stood during the entire 45 minutes we were there. Although I think she did warn me about, being careful not to make sure I didn't get spit on.
Yeah.
So... But yeah. that was a great experience to have a llama in the studio with me while we talked about llamas.
Yes.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, they're fantastic. I really like them a lot, and I think we're seeing more of them, especially alpacas. We're seeing more of them, and I hope that continues because they are interesting and very good to work on.
Mary in O'Connell Falls will give you a chance. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I'm wondering if you have any experience with light therapy, like red light, LED lights, or blue and green lights.
With horses?
I used it on my horses, yep.
I actually don't have any experience with using light therapy. I don't think that we use it here at UW. It's something that I've not done myself before. I do know that it is used in a similar way to how it's used in people. And it can be helpful in some situations.
I was trying to think about how did you use it, Mary?
I just have one red light now, but I had someone who was training to be a red light therapist come over and do my horse, and she used red lights, blue lights, and green lights, and it really did seem to help her with like arthritis in her knee and her hip was sore, and so it did seem like it helped her quite a bit, although the one red light that I have doesn't seem to be quite as good as what she was using, but I was just wondering if you know how it works or anything.
So with respect to how it works, I won't claim to know the details, but it does warm up the tissues, and anything that can, doesn't do any damage but can reduce the need for drugs to control arthritis and pain is always a good thing because they can only take, bute or banamine for so long and it can become toxic. So with the light therapy, if it does seem to have, helpful effect and it's not harmful, then I think that, it's an interesting therapy.
Mary, thank you. Just kind of to go along with this, I think, because the symptoms may be somewhat similar. Julie emailed wondering about Lyme disease in older horses. diagnosis, symptoms, treatment, and any advice for administering medications, you know, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a great question about Lyme disease in horses. We're learning more about it all the time. The challenge with Lyme disease in horses is diagnosing that it is a true problem, that that's what's causing the problem, because in the blood tests, you will have many horses that are positive because they've been exposed. It's very, very common to be exposed. It's very rare that you get a horse that's negative. And there are instances that are proven of Lyme disease causing neurologic symptoms, infecting the bursa at the withers. There's been a few cases recently, but it's very, very common for a horse to be positive, but actually determining if being positive in the blood is what's causing the problem, that is a huge challenge that researchers are working on all the time, mainly at Cornell and at New Bolton Center. They're doing a lot of research. The treatment for Lyme, as in people, is doxycycline or minocycline or a tetracycline, and it can be long term. The problem with that treatment is that is an antibiotic, and it is also an anti-inflammatory, so it may improve symptoms because it's an anti-inflammatory. And so that's another thing that is very, very challenging to determine. I have no doubt that Lyme does occur in horses as it does in people, but trying to figure out which are the true Lyme cases is really difficult. And the problem with, you could say, well, let's just treat them with doxycycline or minocycline just in case. And the problem with that is because it's an antibiotic, you then might develop antibiotic resistance or antibiotic diarrhea. And you need to be sure that you need that antibiotic. So that's the really tough thing with Lyme disease that people are working on very hard research-wise at the moment. So hopefully we'll have some more concrete ways to really tell if they need that antibiotic or not.
Another Julie emailed. First, she wants to thank the awesome large animal vets at UW-Madison several years ago. They saved her horse's life. He was allergic to benamine and has had a full recovery, although it was close for a while. Second, since he can't have benamine, are there good substitutes in general for horses in these kinds of situations? And, you know, what are the best practices to prevent colic?
Thank you for your thanks. I probably wasn't here at the time, but we do have a great team, and we all, you know, we all love what we do, and we love it when we can help an animal and, you know, help the owner as well. So Banamine is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, so an NSAID. So it's like ibuprofen in people, and there are alternatives you can use, such as bute. That's an NSAID, and you can also use ferricoxib, so Equiox. That's an alternative NSAID. So those would be alternatives to Banamine. And Your second question is one that we get asked a lot with respect to colic. And So colic is when the, you know, the horse has intestinal or belly pain, and it can be due to a number of different causes, but the signs are often the same, with rolling, pawing the ground, not wanting to eat, lying down. And with respect to preventing it, it depends what the cause is. And I'd say 50% of the time, we never find out what the cause is. It's just sometimes gas, because gas buildup, you know, if you've had a meal that's disagreed with you yourself, you would know that gas buildup can be very, very painful. And you, if you imagine that pain in the horse, will cause them to roll around and be very painful, and it's gas. Other causes are if they get impacted, so that's impaction of feed that gets very, very hard in their intestine, and it prevents things from going through. And sometimes the gut can twist, and that would be a surgery that would needed to fix that. They can have sand that accumulates. They can have ulcers in their stomach. So there are, I've just listed a few. There are so many different causes. And one of the, you know, the main principal things in trying to prevent it, and, you know, most colics that we get in, it's nothing that anybody has done wrong at all. But one of the foundations of horse care is, if you're going to do a diet change or a pasture change, do it slowly. So introduce new diet changes slowly, and make sure that when it's very hot like it is now, they've got enough water. And then when it's very cold, sometimes if the water freezes, you know, if they don't drink enough, they will get impacted. And then the third thing is dentistry. So make sure they have their teeth checked at least once a year. And as they get older, maybe over 15 years old, twice a year is recommended. So I don't know if I've really answered your question. I could go on for a long time.
I think you've done a very good job, and I'm glad James Herriot's book inspired you into veterinary care and the profession, because you do an excellent job. Hope you'll come back and be with us again. Love to have you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I would love to come back. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for your questions. I very much appreciate it.
Dr. Alexandra Burton, clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. We'll have her back, and we will talk with her again. Fun visiting with her. Tomorrow, though, we're going to space. Astronomers Jim Lattice and Dean Regas join us to guide us through the mind-boggling scale of the universe. So that's tomorrow. But in the meantime, boy, there's lots more in store right through the afternoon on the Ideas Network. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mealer.